calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, Bush is pushing it about as far as you can push it. He's signed a piece of legislation for the Postal Service, you know, kind of reauthorizing them and cleaning up this and that and the other thing. And the legislation itself actually even restates how important it is that our mail be private, first-class mail be private, unless a judge signs a warrant. You can't look into the mail. And Bush attaches a signing statement to it saying, yeah, but I can open your mail. I'm not kidding. There's also an assassination schedule. A right-wing talk show host has announced he's going to start assassinating members of Congress. The new Congress is coming into office today. The U.S. is a lab has been barred from testing electronic voting machines. Why? Because the voting machines that they've been testing for the last few years, their tests are problematic, shall we say. Deadly cost of war continuing to ratchet up. Bush playing politics during the 109th Congress. A lot in the news today. We will be getting to that as we continue throughout our program. But first, it's I think, useful to examine some of these larger issues as well. And Yaron Brook is with us. He's with the Ayn Rand Institute. He's the president and executive director, AYNRAND.org, their website, AynRand.org. Ayn Rand, the founder of Objectivism, the author of Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead and other writings. And the Ayn Rand Institute, the objectivists, the thinkers behind the thinkers who took that thinking and became, some would argue, the libertarians and then the modern-day conservatives. Yaron Brook, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Yaron, you're suggesting, Lindsay Tanner wrote an article in the Associated Press about how fast food in hospitals is being viewed with a jaundiced eye by the hospitals, by the doctors themselves. 59 of the nation's 250 children's hospitals have fast food restaurants. There's a movement to ban fast food restaurants from hospitals. You're opposed to that. Why?
Well, I mean, I'm not opposed to it if the hospitals, most of these hospitals are private hospitals, decide that that's what they want to do. But, you know, I just think that we are getting into a point in this country where, you know, we're going to have a food police, where we're going to have the states start to dictate what we can and cannot eat, what our kids
we
and adults.
Have that.
I mean, we've seen that in New York with the trans fats ban. We're seeing it with the lawsuits against the fast food industry about fat and about french fries. And I think it's scary when the state starts intervening in what we can and cannot eat.
But they're already doing that. If I want to drink unpasteurized milk, for example, I can't do that. The state says, sorry, the benefit to society of milk being pasteurized outweighs your desire to taste unpasteurized milk.
Well, in my view, it shouldn't. That is.
But people die otherwise.
What's that?
But people die otherwise.
Well, then, if somebody decides to eat poison, then they certainly have a right to eat poison and to commit suicide. I don't think it's the state's job to monitor what I eat and what I don't eat. I think people should have a right to drink non-pasteurized milk. I think it would be stupid. I think it would be wrong of them, but people certainly have a right.
But we're talking here about...
Where's the limit, you know?
We're talking about children's hospitals, Yaron. And 15%, 17% of U.S. children now are clinically obese. And when they did a survey of children who had been treated at hospitals that had a McDonald's in them versus children who had had similar treatment in hospitals that didn't have McDonald's, those children who had had treatment for whatever their condition may have been at hospitals with McDonald's were twice as likely to rate McDonald's food as healthy. I mean, there's an implicit endorsement of fast food by fast food restaurants being in hospitals. Why should we as a society not say this is wrong, this is a bad message to send to our children?
Because this is not the job of society. Society has no role to play here. The role here is our parents. I, as a parent, would never let my kids in a hospital eat McDonald's. Let the parents start taking responsibility for the health of their own kids.
But they don't even have to eat
that
McDonald's.
That is what will drive McDonald's ultimately out of business if it's such an evil restaurant chain. Then what will drive them out of business is the reduction in demand. And what will cause that reduction in demand is when parents decide that the food in McDonald's is not good for their kids. It's not society's, whatever that means. It's not the government's role to do that. The government's role is to protect individual rights. It's not to take care of our health. It's not to take care of what we eat. It's not to dictate what we should wear and what we should eat and how we should behave and what we should drive.
Who says?
Leave us alone. Leave us alone and let us make those decisions.
In the Constitution of the United States, it starts out by saying that the reason that we created this was to establish a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves. It doesn't say this government is only here to make sure that anybody can do whatever they damn well please.
I don't accept your interpretation of general welfare, but even if I did, then I'd say the Constitution is wrong. That is, that statement is just plain bad statement that's led to a decline in freedom in this country. What I want is freedom. What I want, it's a sad state when liberalism now means that the government dictates individual behavior. It used to mean that liberalism stood for freedom, stood for individual freedom, that allowed people to do what they wanted, including make mistakes. And what's happening today is that liberals, and unfortunately, and conservatives, the conservatives are no better, are now asking government to take care of us, to have a role in every single part of our life.
Yaron Brook, how can a child be free if that child is obese and has diabetes because they saw a McDonald's in a hospital, and even if their parents wouldn't let them eat there, they saw it and they assumed that that was healthy food. They started eating that way throughout their life, and now they're sick. Isn't
you know, my kids saw those same commercials, and my kids don't eat at McDonald's because they got a different message at home. Their parents told them, no, it's not healthy. You shouldn't eat.
Well, that's marvelous, and I salute you for that. But not all American parents are as good a parent as you are, Yarn.
No, that's true. That's what I say.
And so shouldn't we as a society be protecting our children?
No. Not if that involves getting involved in what they should eat or what. The only thing that the society, i.e. the government, should be involved in is protecting children from physical harm. Because then you get into, you know, parents, there are bad parents.
Isn't diabetes physical harm?
The parents who tell their kids some of the most horrible stories. The parents who tell their kids, ridiculous religious dogmas. How about protecting our kids from bad ideas that these parents teach us? Where is the limit where we as a society are going to intervene in how parents raise their kids?
If you only want to protect children from physical harm, aren't type 2 diabetes and obesity physical harms?
Type 2 diabetes is a disease, and what we need to do is educate parents about what causes it. Most parents don't want their kids to be sick.
But the studies show that when a child goes into a hospital that has a McDonald's, even if they don't eat in it, their perception for the rest of their life is going to be that McDonald's is healthy.
Well,
the hospital has implicitly endorsed it.
It's the parents' job to change that perception, and if the doctors in the hospital and if the hospital administration believes that they should get rid of McDonald's, I certainly wouldn't object to that.
But how can parents stand up?
Government getting involved in this decision-making system.
How can parents stand up to multi-billion-dollar marketing campaigns when it's like
cooking at home, Tom. By cooking at home, all they have to do is not go to the fast food restaurant and make a meal at home like they used to.
But the
That's not hard.
Yeah, for many families, Yaron, it actually is hard.
No,
for millions of families in the United States, it is
families,
hard.
The poorest families in the world used to make food at home, and it's actually cheaper than McDonald's.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree with you that it would be a fine thing, but the reality is that we have parents who are working three jobs just to try to pay the rent. They don't even have time to spend with their kids, much less prepare the meals for their kids. That fast food.
Oh, that's because we have, you know, a lot of economic problems in this country that are primarily derived from too much government intervention.
No, I would say we have economic problems in this country that have derived from ever since 1981, Ronald Reagan taking out the government intervention and throwing us to the wolves of the free market.
You forget the U.S. economy in the 1970s and how awful it was and how much better it is today than the
1970s.
We don't have stagflation. We don't have double-digit unemployment in this country.
In the 1970s, more than half of working families in America were supported by a single wage earner. In fact, as many as 70%, according to some numbers, were supported by a single wage earner who could support a family, put their kids through school, and they had full medical benefits. That's not the case today.
The U.S. economy was losing jobs. Unemployment was
but the jobs we had were better.
Those who had jobs could afford it. Also, the standard of living today of Americans is significantly higher than it was 30 years ago. But the point is that whatever constraints there are on making money, on creating wealth, both for the middle class and the lower classes, has to do with the lack of freedom in this country, way too much government regulation in business. Leave us alone in economics. Leave us alone in the restaurants. Leave us alone in the bedrooms. Let us live our lives.
In the daytime, I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. But at night, I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me. At lunchtime, you can always find me at the Whole Earth Vitamin Bar. And just sucking on my plain white yogurt from my hand-thrown pottery jar. And sipping a little hand-pressed cider with a carrot stick for dessert. And wiping my face in a natural way on the sleeve of my peasant shirt. Yes, I do.
Yes.
Welcome back to the radio support group. I'll buy it for we, the people of the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. There's a lot of news today, which we are going to be getting into as we continue through the program. Of course, every day dealing with the hottest topics and the hottest news and the largest issues. And I would submit to you that the largest issue facing America right now is the issue of corporate power, is the issue of who's really in charge here, is the issue of are we a nation of laws and people in society, or are we a nation of by and for the capitalist few, as it were. Mark Hanna is the guy that Karl Rove says he has modeled himself after. And Mark Hanna, this is fascinating. I'm just digging through some old archives here. The McKinley-Bryant campaign, you know, when William McKinley ran against William Jennings Bryant. The chairman of the Republican National Committee at that time was Mark Hanna, and he became McKinley's handler. And as I said, Karl Rove says he's modeled himself after Mark Hanna. This is a quote from a newspaper in 1906. Most of McKinley's $6 to $7 million in campaign funds came because Hanna levied regular assessments on all businesses of consequence throughout the country. Incredible. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Harlan in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Harlan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good. I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I'm a big fan of yours. I even read one of your books about the Hunter Farmer. I just wanted to add, you know, that I practice law in California, and that this is a classic case of what we call, amongst lawyers, paternalism. And most of it, 99% of it, we would agree is good. We have speed laws. We have laws against smoking in public places. We have tax laws that promote, let's say, behavior that we want, such as people owning homes and stuff. The question that needs to be asked when you're talking about trans fat and fast foods is, what's the overwhelming public response? And I think from where I sit, and I think from where you sit, you'd have to agree that the overwhelming public response is not one of anger against laws that would regulate trans fats and fast foods. And I think that's the barometer of public opinion. And that's what determines whether paternalism is on the right track. And you don't see people lining up against airbags, against seatbelts, against speed limits. And it's the same thing. And this guy that you had as a guest, it sounds good to promote more freedom. We all agree with that. But in the end, we need the government to provide some basic protections from us so that we individuals can live a prosperous life and actually exercise those freedoms.
Right, to protect and to protect us from the predators among us in society. Franklin Roosevelt in 1936 said in July of 1936 when he accepted his nomination for the second term as president, quoted an old English judge. He said, an old English judge once said, a necessitous man is not a free man. In other words, if you're hungry, you're not free. If you can't pay the rent, you're not free. And you know, freedom is more than just the right to do whatever you damn well please.
When you talk to these guys, you should have a list and say, I suppose you want to get rid of speed limits, you want to get rid of anti-smoking campaigns, you get rid of limits on the age that you can drink alcohol, all these things that are designed to have a more protective and free society for everyone. And if they answer yes to that, then you can basically say, you're nuts.
Yeah, well, or you're a libertarian. I mean, that's you know, I say libertarians are Republicans who smoke pot and want to get laid.
And I'm not advocating turning this over to the realm of public opinion, because you can see where that can go awry. Proposition 13 in California and Measure 37 in Oregon, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Oh, yeah.
And so we can have excesses of power in place of the people, but we need to rely on our elected representatives to protect us, not the corporations.
Yeah, amen. Harlan, thanks a lot for the call. Well
Thank
said.
Thank
you. Cal driving in Ohio. Hey, Cal, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. What's on your mind today?
Hey, can you hear me?
I can.
I was just wondering if this is true or not. I heard yesterday that the minimum wage in Great Britain is like equal to about $9 and change.
I believe that's true, yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's in that neighborhood. I don't, you know, it's been 6 months since we had a discussion about that on the air. I don't remember the exact number. But, yeah, it's the minimum wage in Great Britain is particularly given the fact that everybody has free health insurance, is basically a living wage.
But do you think that's the reason that we're having such a big problem over here? Is it just the corporations, or is it just because our country is just so much bigger? Or are we just...
No, in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and the early 80s in the United States, we actually had a strong middle class. The problem is that a strong middle class, and also back in the 1760s, 70s, and 80s, we had a strong middle class. And the problem is when you have a strong middle class, that middle class will tend to get uppity. They get out in the streets, the kids are out there protesting, the women are saying, hey, we want equal rights. You got African Americans saying, hey, what about us? You got gays saying, we're part of society. And the conservatives look at that and they go, holy cow, we've got a society in meltdown. We can't have this. And so they try to take us back to the way it was in the United States from basically the Civil War until the Republican Great Depression, where there was, for all practical purposes, no strong middle class. There were a few family farms. That was about it for the middle class. And they're doing it again. They're doing it again. They're destroying the middle class. 27 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Herman Radio Program for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tomorrow, I will be doing this program live from WPTT, the studios of WPTT 1360 AM in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And that evening, I will be doing a book signing for my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, which Amazon's offering an additional 5% off. But anyhow, that will be at Borders in Monroeville, Pennsylvania, at 7 p.m. It's on Mall Boulevard. And then on Saturday, I will be in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and at 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon at the Lindale United Church of Christ, I will be giving a talk on Screwed, again, on the book, and the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and a book signing. This is sponsored by Magers and Quinn, the bookstore, magersandquinn.com, for all the information, or you can give them a call if you want that. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. John in Seattle, listening on WPTK. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
You can hear me?
I can.
Oh, okay. Wasn't sure it was me. I just want to make a comment about the fellow from Ayn Rand. I've listened to him several times. And the topic this time, fast food, I just want to say, as usual, he spits out empty calories in terms of intellectual thought. And, he's a stop.
Let's not pick on people personally. I mean, Yaron really believes what he believes. And he really, I think he really believes, as most folks who share that philosophy, that if we really had complete freedom, in quotes. If there was no government, no laws, no rules, except, you know, those necessary to prevent people from doing violence to each other, that it would be a wonderful world. It's just the problem is it's never been tried anywhere. It's never succeeded anywhere.
Well, and I've got some friends that get wrapped up in Ayn Rand, and they get narrower and narrower. I keep wanting to tell them, you need to go back, read the great books, get a liberal arts education, and put things in perspective. And I think Ayn Rand will be on the ash heap of intellectual thought. You know, it's sophistry what they're doing. And I just, it makes me want to scream sometimes listening to that guy.
Yeah. Well, but the problem is he represents a worldview which is shared by increasingly most of the Republican Party, a startling chunk of the Democratic Party, and an awful lot of young people. It's become very hip to be a libertarian because libertarians are in favor of decriminalizing prostitution and pot, and yet they're putting forward these conservative economic ideologies that are based on objectivism, which is what Yaron is promoting. And I think it's just really important that at every opportunity we confront this ideology and call it out and point it out.
Yeah, my daughter's in law school. I recently, 6 months or so ago, I gave her the whole stack of Ayn Rand books, and I said, read these so you understand what the other side is thinking.
Yeah, well, and also know that John Galt was an employee of the railroad when he invented that thing, and so theoretically, according to today's law, the railroad owns it, not John Galt, which totally blows up the Atlas Shrugged. But in any case, John, thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah, hey, and I enjoyed your visits when you come up here to Seattle. I was in that screaming crowd at Town Hall last summer.
Oh, that was
a great show.
That was a hoot. Thank you very much. I hope we get up there again soon. Good talking
Alrighty.
With you, John. Thanks for the call. James in New Paul's, New York. Hey, James, what's on your mind today?
Oh, Happy New Year, Tom, to you and your family.
Thank you. The same to you, James.
I'm a registered dietitian involved in public health, and listening to that last person, I don't even know where to begin. First of all, let me just say childhood obesity is not just a problem, it's a public health epidemic.
It's a crisis.
Yes, it's a crisis. We are seeing children, I'm talking about children now, with marked signs of type 2 diabetes. We're seeing children needing insulin. We're seeing children with hypertension. And the thing about these conditions is once they start, they stay with you for life.
Right, and these are conditions that typically showed up in people in their 50s and 60s that were the consequence of a lifetime of bad habits. I'm personally of the opinion that corn syrup plays a huge role in all this.
That was my next point. I think this high fructose corn syrup is something they should really look at and ought to be banned. The thing about high fructose corn syrup is that when it's digested in the body, it goes right into the portal vein. It doesn't even...
right into the liver.
Yeah, and it doesn't even stimulate an insulin response. It's really, the body treats it more like a fat than a carbohydrate.
Interesting.
I don't mean to sound too technical, but
I started my rant about high fructose corn syrup about 3 or 4 years ago when I read a paper that just was comparing an epidemiological study comparing the amount of high fructose corn syrup in the American diet with the rates of obesity and type 2 diabetes. And there's about a 3-year lag between the two, but the lines almost perfectly parallel each other, at least in the study that I saw. And I started talking about it on the radio, and in the last 3 years, I can't tell you how many people, it's probably been at least a few dozen anyway, which is, I suppose, a lot for, you know, just something that's totally empirical like this, non-scientific, let's say. The number of people who have called and said, I just took corn syrup out of my diet, did nothing else, and I lost 20 pounds.
I believe it.
For example. So you're suggesting, James, that we should not allow fast food restaurants in our hospitals, period.
If it were up to me, I would ban them altogether, but that's, you know, maybe that's a little extreme by most people's standards. But, I see very little good in them. I have labor issues, the way they treat their people, the way the agribusiness that they use to provide them with these cheap products. I have a lot of issues, and I could probably spend all day,
capitalize
your time.
And the destruction of the rainforest in South America so we can have cheap beef. James, thank you for the call. And for making a good point and doing it briefly. Kim in San Francisco, listening on the Quake. Hey, Kim.
Hey, I love the show.
Thank you.
I want to ask a question of the gentleman that was espousing sort of the Ayn Rand theory. In society, for instance, I got sick and we couldn't have our own kids, so we adopted. The child that we adopted from the county had a heroin-addicted birth mother. According to the way he feels about government intrusion, Do children that are born with nothing, babies that are born with nothing in society, that have no parents to guide them, whose parents abandoned them, is it just and right that they should just be relegated to the trash heap of society and left to die? I mean,
I don't want to try to speak on behalf of Yaron, and he's not here to say his own words, but I can tell you we've had this debate enough times. I've had this debate enough times with both Yaron and a whole bunch of people from, you know, Competitive Enterprise Institute to the Republican Party to be able to, I think, reasonably put forward their point of view, which would be that if government got out of the business altogether of providing social services, then churches and charities and particularly high-minded people of great wealth, you know, the Scrooge and Bob Marley syndrome would kick in and people would be shamed into helping. Now, history doesn't demonstrate that. What history demonstrates, you go back and you look at Victorian England, which is the kind of economy that you end up with total laissez-faire economics, unregulated economics, what you find is that you have a large number of people who are dying of starvation, and you have orphanage, you know, orphans and orphanages and kids who are exploited by people for a whole variety, you know, for labor and sexually and every other way, simply because, you know, they have nothing to turn to. But the theory is that if government doesn't do it, that and this is George Bush's theory, by the way. It's one of the reasons why he let New Orleans go down. I mean, here, 4 days after the snow in the Great Plains, we're dropping feed by the ton into cattle. 4 days after. It took us 6 days to drop food and water into New Orleans.
Right.
Because Bush actually believed, and the ideologues in his administration actually believed, that if government stayed out of it, that private charities would get in there and they'd do a wonderful job and they'd be able to say, see, we told you so. The government should not, we shouldn't even have a FEMA. We should leave this all up to Pat Robertson and Operation Blessing. It didn't work out that way, as I would have predicted, as I did predict, but that's what they were expecting. They were expecting the same thing in Iraq. They said, you know, we're not going to rebuild the country. We're not going to provide security. The market will do that. It didn't. These guys are ideologues. They don't, you know, they believe this to be true, but empirical evidence demonstrates that it's not.
And, you know, the thing is if we depend on those wealthy individuals to donate enough money to charitable organizations to support these people and these babies, well, we know for a fact that as a portion of income, the middle class tends to donate more as a portion of their income to charities than do the wealthy. This is a fact.
Yeah.
Also,
it also provides a rationalization. It says, therefore, we need rich people, extremely rich people in society, because they will be the patrons.
And if anybody's read Angela's Ashes, if you remember, because his mother was on the dole, she had to go to the Catholic Church, and it enraged this little kid that went with her at how the priests made each individual beg, and they simply chose by virtue of who they thought had the most compelling story.
There's something ultimately very demeaning about that. Kim, thank you for the call and for the excellent point. Terry in Macon, Georgia. Hey, Terry, we've got to take a break in about a minute. What's up?
Hello?
Hey, Terry, you're live and on the air.
Okay, I'm going to be quick. One quick question.
Sure.
How can we talk about outlawing hamburgers when we have cigarettes legal?
Well, I think it's part of the whole larger thing. I mean, you know, cigarettes have been grandfathered in, essentially, because they were here before we were a country. But I agree with you that the cigarettes, here you have a substance that's five times more addictive than heroin. Say that again?
What kills more than cigarettes?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah, 400,000 people a year in the United States die from cigarettes. Over 2 million people a year in the world. Absolutely. And not only that, the tobacco companies, we only discovered this like 10, 15 years ago, the tobacco companies add ammonia to cigarettes. Why? Because it makes them more alkaline. Why do they want to make it more alkaline? Because they want to freebase the nicotine. It's the same thing as freebasing cocaine. They make it more alkaline. It sticks to the blood faster, so go bang! It hits your bloodstream much faster, so you get a sudden high. People who smoke cigarettes these days are freebasing nicotine, just like crack addicts are freebasing cocaine. It makes it much more addictive. Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's something that we should be doing something about also. Thank you for the call, by the way. 45 minutes past the hour.
To walk within the lines could make my life so boring. I want to know that I have been to the extreme.
And welcome back. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program. That's me, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. DJ in Phoenix, Arizona on the line. Hey, DJ.
Hi.
What's up? Hello? I think we just lost DJ. Let's try Tanya in Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Tanya.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. What's up?
I love your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment about the gentleman who was speaking about the McDonald's issue.
In hospitals, in children's hospitals.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely disgusting. I've had a weight problem my entire life, and I have a young child, and I try to keep him away from that stuff as much as possible.
Because you grew up on it and it didn't do you well? Is that, you
no,
know?
It didn't do me well at all.
Yeah.
You know, I stay away from it also, and it has helped. It's helped wonders.
Good.
You know,
good.
A few years ago I went through my cabinets and I took out all the items that contained corn syrup.
Yeah. I think it's really important that we continue to hold up the ideal of individual responsibility and parental responsibility. I think, you know, Yaron makes a good point. But the simple fact of the matter is that no parent can stand up against billions of dollars of advertising. And there's all these subtle messages, like, you know, children go to hospitals where they're told that, you know, these are the temples of healing, and there's a McDonald's in there. I mean, what kind of message does that send?
Oh,
it's just,
yeah, it's terrible.
Crazy.
And, yeah. You know, even when they, if they watch cartoons, you know, a half-hour cartoon show, they're bombarded with junk food commercials.
Absolutely. Tanya, very well said. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Bill in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Tom, love the show. I've been listening for several months now. It's and I bought your book, Screwed, and it's fantastic.
Great. Well, thank you. Well, yeah, what's on your mind?
Oh, yeah. I want to know why you always make it sound like a bad thing, liking pot and getting laid.
I'm actually in favor of both.
in a large way. Anyway.
Well, my point is most Republicans don't like pot and don't want to get laid, and the libertarians are the ones who are Republicans, but they want to smoke pot and get laid because, you know, basically, economically and in terms of society, the libertarian worldview is you're on your own, Charlie, and we're not a society, and it's all for the corporations. And the government should keep its nose out of what you're smoking and who you're sleeping with. And I agree with the latter part, but the former part, no thanks.
Yeah, early days, I kind of got into Ayn Rand and the whole libertarian thing, and then I took the pill for the matrix.
There you go. Yeah.
Here's what I wanted to ask about, though, and get your opinion on anyway. As long as we're protecting the children and the like from fast food and from themselves and their parents, which to a large degree I agree with. I'm still wondering why we legally, using the guise of church and state, allow parents to kill their children based on their disbelief in medicine.
You mean allowing Christian Science, that kind of thing? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, well, the Christian Science is yes, but they're not the most nasty sect in doing that. I mean, you live in Oregon. You remember that case where they let the diabetic child die and no charges were pressed?
Yeah, I didn't live here at the time, I don't think, but yes, and to the best of my knowledge, well, geez, you know, that's a really tough one, Bill, because as a society, one of the foundations of our society is allowing people to practice their own religion. Another one of the foundations of our society is that we protect our children, we protect ourselves, and it's.
But how can you possibly let somebody's belief system win out over a child's life?
Yeah, no, I don't think that you should. Frankly, I think that if there's a medical treatment that we know, you know, giving insulin to a diabetic child is going to keep that child alive. Absolutely. On the other hand, sometimes there are controversial medical treatments. For example, some kinds of chemotherapy. They really don't have that much better survival rates than without chemotherapy, and they make life miserable. Should a parent who doesn't believe in you know, religiously, believes that it's wrong to use medicine, be forced to use chemotherapy that might only increase the probability of a lifespan by 1 or 2%?
Well, I agree in that situation, but I mean, like you said before, the more direct ones where obviously all it's going to take is a couple of shots a day to keep this person alive until they're 80, and yet they're allowed to roll over and die.
Yeah, yeah. See, this is one of those areas, Bill. I think our conversation is demonstrating the fact that nothing is cut and dry, and we need to, we all need to be continually aware of the fact that there are shades of gray in our society. Bill, thank you for the call. Thoughtful, insightful. Charles in Georgetown, Kentucky. Hey, Charles.
Hello, Tom. I just want to say I agree with 99% of what you say. I'm probably as anti-corporate as you are, but I think this is one step too far. I disagree with fast food in hospitals. I think it reflects poorly on the hospital, but I don't think that it's something that should be regulated by the government.
Even though we know that when children see fast food restaurants in hospitals, they spend the rest of their lives thinking that fast food is somehow associated with healing.
Well, I see your point, but at the same time...
I mean, this is a subliminal form of advertising, Charles.
I agree, but it's our responsibility as adults and parents to educate our children and let them know, yes, that's what...
Right, but still, I mean, they have the experience of going into a hospital when they're sick and getting healed. That's something that happens way below the level of consciousness. That's absolutely visceral. It's a feeling thing. And in that hospital, they're going to associate the hospital experience with getting well, and there's that McDonald's. They're going to build that in as the association. This is subliminal advertising.
It's something that the hospital should self-regulate.
Yeah.
I agree with you that they shouldn't be there, but it shouldn't be regulated.
Okay, point made. I appreciate the call, George. Charles, in Georgetown. I respectfully disagree, but I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be back with more of the news of the day and your calls right after the news at the top of the hour. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Over in the chat room, there's still a lively discussion going on about sugar and corn syrup and food. And this one, JSF makes a note, sugarcane as a more efficient way to produce ethanol is a great reason to normalize relations with Cuba. Yeah. Interesting comments there. By the way, Andrew in New York, who's mixing the program at Air America headquarters in New York, the main studio. I'm broadcasting from Portland, and through the magic of ISDN lines, it sounds like we're in the same room. But Andrew, if you don't mind opening your mic for a second and telling us what you told me right after the top of the last hour, what you witnessed on television. Okay. Well, he's take just a second to pot up his mic, if you don't mind. I thought it was a pretty amazing story. Andrew has we don't have a TV on in the studio here, and Andrew has a TV in the studio, and so he was able to watch CNN the swearing in ceremony, and so it's Dick Cheney's job to swear in the new senators, and. Andrew, I don't know how long I'm going to have to wait for this.
Can you hear me?
No, I can't hear you. Yeah. Okay, it's not going to work. All right. Well, I'll just tell people what you said. What Andrew told me he saw was Dick Cheney having to swear in Bernie Sanders. And he said the look on Dick Cheney's face was just absolutely priceless. It was like one of those, oh, my God, I really don't want to be here looks on his face. You know, having to swear in Dick Cheney, amazing. The Union of Concerned Scientists just came out with a report. A new report from the Union of Concerned Scientists offers the most comprehensive documentation to date of how ExxonMobil has adopted the tobacco industry's disinformation tactics, as well as some of the same organizations and personnel, to cloud the scientific understanding of climate change and delay action on the issue. ExxonMobil spent more than $16 million between 1998 and 2005 to a network of 43 advocacy organizations to confuse the public on global warming. And they just lay it all out. The title of the study is Smoke, Mirrors, and Hot Air, How ExxonMobil Uses Big Tobacco's Tactics to Manufacture Uncertainty on Climate Change Details. Excuse me. And, they're definitely doing it. Definitely doing it. Perhaps the most outrageous story of the day. And this just totally, totally blew my mind when I saw this. I mean, I thought I'd seen everything. But this is beyond the pale. George Bush, this is from the Daily News, the New York Daily News. It's not even the New York Times or the Washington Post, although maybe they'll be picking it up. But James Gordon Meek, the Daily News Washington bureau chief, wrote this article for the New York Daily News. This is a local paper. I mean, it's a large paper, but New York's a large city. President Bush has quietly claimed sweeping new powers to open Americans' mail without a judge's warrant, the Daily News has learned. You get this? So now, he doesn't have to have somebody from Arlen Specter's office tap into Ted Kennedy's computer anymore. He can simply open Ted Kennedy's mail. Or your mail. Or my mail. The president asserted his, now back to the article, the president asserted his new authority when he signed a postal reform bill into law on December 20th. Bush then issued a signing statement that declared his right to open people's mail under emergency conditions. That claim is contrary to existing law and contradicted the bill he had just signed, say experts who have reviewed it. Bush's move came during winter congressional recess and a year after his secret domestic electronic eavesdropping program was first revealed. It caught Capitol Hill by surprise. Yeah, I'd say so. Congressman Henry Waxman, the Democrat from California, incoming House Government Reform Committee chairman. I mean, talk about, kicking sand in your face or poking in the eye or whatever. I mean, here's Bush. Yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, he's saying, let's have a little bipartisanship and let's work together, me and the Democrats. By the way, I can open your mail if I want. I don't have to, there's that thing called the Constitution. Forget it. I mean, it's right there. The Fourth Amendment. The right of people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. And papers has certainly been interpreted to mean mail. Against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly, in other words, specifically, describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Well, the Fourth Amendment was fine for George Washington. The Fourth Amendment was fine for John Adams. Actually, John Adams didn't like it that much. It was fine for Thomas Jefferson. It was okay for James Madison, even though he fought the War of 1812. Even though the White House was burned down when James Madison was president, he still kept the Fourth Amendment intact, didn't read people's mail. Monroe after him and Jackson after him, and I'm forgetting the order of everybody else now, all the way up to Lincoln, and then, all the way through the Reconstruction and into the 20th. Every president has acknowledged that we have a right to privacy in our mail. Now, we all acknowledge that the FBI or the local police agencies or whatever should have the right to open somebody's mail if they think that there's something illegal in it, but they have to demonstrate to a judge that they have a probable cause to believe that. You don't just willy-nilly say to a politician like George W. Bush, okay, that's fine, you can open anybody's mail you damn well please. It's wrong. Henry Waxman says, despite the president's statement that he may be able to circumvent a basic privacy protection, the new postal law continues to prohibit the government from snooping into people's mail without a warrant. Experts said the new powers, this is back to the article from the New York Daily News, experts said the new powers could be easily abused and used to vacuum up large amounts of mail. See, it was kind of a gray area when it was our email. After all, it's going through the Internet. It's not going through the Postal Service. It's going through corporate mail servers. I mean, there was a presumption of privacy, but there wasn't a clear constitutional guarantee of privacy. But when it comes to the Postal Service, When it comes to our mail, there has been a clear presumption of privacy built into this law for over 200 years. Kate Martin, the director of the Center for National Security Studies in Washington, she says the Bush signing statement claims authority to open domestic mail without a warrant, and that would be new and quite alarming. The danger is that they're reading Americans' mail. A career senior U.S. official who reviewed the legal underpinnings of Bush's claim, this would be somebody who doesn't want to speak, you know, who wants to only speak anonymously for fear of losing their job, said to the reporter from the New York Daily News, you have to be concerned. It takes executive branch authority beyond anything we've ever known. You know, when Hitler took over Germany, he passed the Enabling Acts. He got the Enabling Acts pushed through Congress, or pushed through the Parliament. And at least, through the Reichstag, at least he got a law passed that said that he could open people's mail. Bush writes the law himself in a signing statement. Most of the Postal Accountability Enhancement Act deals with mundane reform measures, but it also explicitly reinforced protections of first-class mail from searches without the court's approval. Yet in his statement, Bush said he will construe an exception which provides for opening of an item of a class of mail otherwise sealed against inspection in a manner consistent with the need to conduct services in exigent circumstances. End of quote. That's what his signing statement says. I can do it if I decide that it's an emergency. Bush cited his examples to protect human life and safety against hazardous materials and the need for physical services searches specifically authorized by law for foreign intelligence collection. Yeah, right. Emily Lorimore, Bush spokeswoman, White House spokeswoman, denied he was claiming any new authorities. Critics point out the administration could quickly get a warrant from a criminal court or a foreign intelligence surveillance court to search targeted mail, and the Postal Service can block delivery in the meantime. You know, if they think that that there's a letter that has anthrax in it or has bomb-making instructions or says, hey, Osama, meet me at the corner of 4th and Main, they can simply say to the postmaster, hey, hang on to that letter for a day or two while we get a warrant. Or under the FISA law, they could just go in and open it, and they've got 3 days to get a warrant. But none of that is good enough for Bush. He says, I'm going to do it, I'm not going to tell you, and I ain't going to tell no stinking judges. This is terrible. 16 minutes past the hour. Yeah, look out for those Republicans. Welcome back to the radio support group. I'm fighting for we the people of the United States of America. AJ in the chat room, she says, I want the postmaster to open every man's Viagra prescription. We have some militant women in our chat room, I'll tell you. Oh, man. Andy says, Tom, remember what Bernie Sanders said they were going to do about, they're going to address the signing statements. Yeah, that's probably why Dick Cheney looked like he was sucking on a lemon when he signed in, when he swore in Bernie Sanders. And, by the way, January 11th, Placidus Roy shares this in the chat room. You can get to the chat room by going to tomhartman.com if you want to drop in. It's no fee or anything. It's just, it's there. It's, you can hang out. Yeah, you just have to have the most recent version of Java. January 11, 2007 will mark the fifth anniversary of the first detainees to be imprisoned in the U.S. military prison at the U.S. Naval Base Guantanamo. Only 10 of the 770 prisoners have been charged using the so-called Guantanamo process. It's pretty grim. I refer to it as a concentration camp. Actually, it's a series of them. There are six of them, and the sixth one has a death camp built into it. Is George W. Bush disconnecting himself from reality? I'll tell you about that after the break. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. We have on the table laissez-faire economics, food in hospitals, George Bush opening our mail. There's a pile of other things happening. Of course, Congress being sworn in today. You know, is Nancy Pelosi going to make this thing happen? Yeah, we'll see how it all shakes out. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington on the line. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Tom, I want to thank you for bringing this subject to light. I'm a letter carrier and a union activist and a delegate to the AFL-CIO.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you, I am outraged. When I heard about this yesterday, I about broke down in tears. We fought for years to get this reform bill passed. We negotiated with these damn management types to make sure that we had our leave taken care of, you know, to make sure that everything's all set. And we fought for years to get this thing passed.
This piece of legislation
to just
Bush signed.
Trash all over this bill. It's like just a slap in the face to every letter carrier and every clerk and every mail handler in America. And as a union guy, I want to tell all my brothers and sisters to go to your next union meeting and to make a resolution that you oppose this signing statement and you oppose all signing statements, because this is the definition of tyranny.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Jeff. And I would assume that as a letter carrier, you have always had and been held in that high regard of, this is somebody of great integrity, and I don't have to worry about the fact that this guy's carrying my mail. I mean, people make jokes from time to time about letter carriers reading postcards, but nobody ever even hallucinates that letter carriers might be opening their mail. And now Bush has created a world with this signing statement where people are going to start looking at you guys with a jaundiced eye.
Yeah, they're going to look at us like we're the Gestapo.
Yeah. I mean,
or the clerks or the people you go to the window.
Yeah.
They're going to think we're the bad guy, and we are union members. We are the people who fight for your rights. We're the people who stand up for you when nobody else will.
Yeah.
And they're going to just trash us like this. I think this president has got to go.
Yeah, he is doing incredible damage to democracy in America, and we need to open investigations that may well end up with impeachment of this guy, because he is committing crimes of against democracy of just absolutely epic proportions. Jeff, thank you for the call.
Well, can I just tell everybody to go to the union and go to the AFL-CIO and make a motion that this is wrong?
Yeah, I think you already did.
Thank you very much.
But I'll let you second it. Yeah. There you go. Thanks, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. Lonnie in Eugene, Oregon, listening on KOPT. Hey, Lonnie.
Oh, hi. You know, I called about the food issue because I cured myself of arthritis a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys were talking about McDonald's being in the hospital.
Right.
You know, I recently broke my knee in July, and I went to the hospital to spend the night, and I woke up. I started crying because I couldn't get any food.
Like, oh, because that's a whole other issue. The hospitals themselves serve pretty disgusting stuff.
Well, I mean, that's the point. I mean, if you're going to eliminate McDonald's, you eliminate Coca-Cola. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that's really bad. I mean, we have a very sick, unhealthy society because of our food supply. And I think this issue about McDonald's is really about the food cloning. Like, they're trying to make this an issue to say, oh, it's okay for these to be in hospitals. It's kind of like easing people's minds it's like mind manipulation.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm curious, Lonnie. We have to take a break here in about 30 seconds, but I get arthritis in my fingers if I eat a lot of potatoes, tomatoes, eggplants, hot peppers.
The
nightshade family. And my mother actually had quite bad arthritis, and when she quit eating all those nightshade plants, it went away, and she hasn't had it since she was in her 60s. She's, you know, pushing 80 now. Is that what you did?
Well, I eliminated a lot of chemicals from my body, and I, you know what, a basic thing, though, is apple cider vinegar morning and night will ease arthritis. Really.
Oh, interesting. Okay,
but it has to be unfiltered.
Yeah, I was curious about that, because I have just come across a startling number of people who, when they took nightshade family foods.
That does actually encourage it, because there's something in it. But,
yeah,
you know,
I think some people are allergic to it.
The postal thing, too, Tom, you know, my mail's already been being filtered. I don't know about you, but I know mine was.
Yeah, well, see, that takes a court order, so you need to check out what's going on. Lonnie, thank you for the call. Yeah. I'm sorry we're out of time. But interesting. We'll be back with more of your calls after this. And more of the news of the day. And is Bush actually announcing an exit strategy from reality? 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
In the good old USA, I'm proud to say, we got the brand new action, good old fashioned too. And the future's so bright, like stars in the night. just smiling down on everything we do. Great big harvest moon, things happen, lovers too.
And welcome back. Fair and slightly unbalanced, it's the Tom Hartman Program, that's me. It's a listener-supported radio supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Listen to your local affiliates, your local stations for the sponsors that, because those are the folks who are supporting your local stations, and that's how you can support them. Listen for your local sponsors, patronize them, give them a call, let them know you're listening. And also our national sponsors, Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, sacredgroundscoffee.com, 1-800-425-2532. Or Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now, 1-800-511-MAX and smalldog.com. And the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, ecowine.com. 35 minutes past the hour. I promised you this off the wire service. President George W. Bush has been working around the clock to put the finishing touches on a speech to the American people in which he will announce a comprehensive exit strategy from reality. White House aides confirmed today, when reports emerged that the president was considering deploying an additional surge of troops in Iraq against the advice of military experts and overwhelming public sentiment, many in Washington suspected that the move was part of a larger plan to withdraw from reality entirely. But not until spokesperson Tony Snow addressed reporters today did the White House officially confirm that the president was about to announce an exit strategy from the land of rational thought. As Mr. Snow told reporters, the president never intended to occupy the world of reality indefinitely. He's planning a new way forward, and that way forward is a one-way ticket to fantasy land. Moments after Mr. Snow announced Mr. Bush's plan to unveil an exit strategy from reality, members of the press corps started peppering him with questions about a deadline by which the president will have totally taken leave of his senses. The White House spokesman said the president refused to set a formal timetable for his withdrawal from reality, but added that it's a realistic assumption that Mr. Bush's exit from the real world will be complete by the end of 2007. It helps, said Snow, that he's 90% of the way there already. Thanks to Andy Borowitz, borowitzreport.com, for a moment of levity in an otherwise kind of bizarre news day. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. John in Los Angeles. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Hi. How you doing, Tom? Just want to, but the first hour you had the guy from the Ayn Rand Corporation.
Yeah, Yaron Brook.
Yeah, and he was talking about, basically how the libertarian view is of life and what our rights should be or whatever. And the thing is, I've noticed many things that, you know, I know this isn't the libertarians, but basically the Republicans, they're hypocritical in the fact that they're against drugs, they're against sex, they're against so many things, yet they're the major party getting caught doing all these things, but they won't even go against these drugs that are being added to our food that significantly, I mean, have an adverse effect on our lives and how we live them.
Yeah, good point. Plus they preach that they want to stay out of people's lives, but they're the first ones to call a special session of Congress, and George Bush gets on Air Force One and burns a couple hundred thousand gallons of jet fuel to fly to Washington, D.C. in the middle of the night to sign legislation to keep Terry Schiavo alive.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really ridiculous. I'm really tired of everything that's been going on.
Yeah, these guys are just plain old flat-out Looney Tunes, John.
And so, his wife here, you know, she had skin cancer, and we don't even know what really how in depth that is gone.
Well, it's probably she had squamous cell skin cancer. It's fairly common, and typically, if you catch it early, not much of a problem. But you know, I'm not so concerned about that as I am about what they're doing policy wise. I think that is a real problem. John, thanks a lot for the call.
Okay.
Siri in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Siri.
Hey, I just wanted to commend you as one of the only talk show hosts out there that can win their arguments without personal attacks or the mute button.
Oh, thank you.
I think Sean Hannity could definitely take a listen or two from you, but I called
The problem is he's on the wrong side of the argument. That's why he has to resort to personal attacks and the mute button.
Well, you can tell when he's losing because he starts asking people who they voted for.
Yeah. as if their ideology means that you can write them off, right?
Yeah. All of a sudden, like, that's relevant to every subject he's discussing. But anyway, yeah. The reason I called is just as someone that works at the lower end of, you know, the whole corporate socioeconomic dynamic in this country. I just think it's fascinating how the people at the top don't really consider the same motivation for their efforts to be universal, in the sense that they work harder when they make more money. And
well, that's the theory anyway.
Huh?
That's their theory. You know, give me $300 million and I'll work harder than when you gave me $30 million. Give me $1.78 billion like William McGuire got at United Health, and I'll work 1,000 times harder than when I only got $178 million.
Yeah, but if someone at the bottom wants a raise, or, you know, is wants something besides like a T-shirt from Walmart for working there for 20 years, then they're greedy and they don't know what it takes to run a business. And,
right.
And you know, they should be happy for what they have. And I just think there's been this real trend towards corporate feudalism in this country.
You're right.
Over the last few years. And,
you're right.
You know, you often have guests on your show that get up and you know, they make it sound like all these people that own these companies are just inherently benevolent people, and therefore we should just let them do whatever they want, and they're going to do the right thing.
Well, and, you know, the reality is that, and Teddy Roosevelt, by the way, had some brilliant speeches on this. I reproduce one of them in my book, Unequal Protection. The reality is that a lot of small businesses actually are run in a fairly benevolent fashion, because mm-hmm. the small business owner has to live in the same community and look face to face, look in the eyes of the people that they're working with.
Exactly.
And there's a level of humanity there that doesn't exist when you're talking about a big multinational corporation where somebody in New York City makes a decision or pushes a button, and 500 people in Kansas City, Missouri, lose their jobs.
But what I noticed from them is they don't have any of the loyalty that they expect their workers to have.
Yeah.
And they expect those workers to have it for nothing.
Yeah.
You know, that you should just work out of the kindness of your heart, and that you should be happy knowing that the owner of your company, you know, just made $300 million this year, but you haven't seen even a cost of living wage. And I just think it's laughable that the Supreme Court justices, who make, what, $165,000 a year, they're complaining about their cost of living, and we haven't had a minimum wage raise in how many years? I mean, it just seems to me that someone making $5 an hour probably has some cost of living issues right about now, too.
Yeah, John Roberts going on and on. He's the Chief Justice, saying his $203,000 a year salary is not enough. It's causing a crisis. And I had a caller on my morning show this morning say, you know, well, wouldn't this be a great opportunity to get some good middle-class folks on the court?
Yeah.
I mean, people who think that $200,000 is a lot of money. Let's bring them in and put them on the Supreme Court. It, you know, because if you extend the logic of John Roberts' argument, this is his, for those listeners who are not familiar with this, once a year the Chief Justice writes up a summary of what he considers to be the big issues of the day. And typically it deals with two or three issues. Only twice in the last 100 years has it only dealt with a single issue. It has never dealt with pay. And it has a single issue. And John Roberts wrote a 9-page summary about what he saw as the biggest constitutional crisis facing America, and it's the fact that he's not getting paid enough. And the assumption implicit in that is that if you're going to be on the Supreme Court, you should be drawn from the class of the wealthy and the extremely wealthy, which John Roberts was. He was born into a very wealthy family. He was earning over $1 million a year as a corporate lawyer before he went to work for, before he became the, you know, he was put on the Supreme Court. Back in the day when George W. Bush had him come, go down to, or Jim Baker had him go down to Florida in 2000, and, you know, along with John Bolton and all those guys pounding on the windows. And John Roberts' job was to train the lawyers who were going to argue before Rehnquist, before the Supreme Court, because Roberts used to be a clerk for Rehnquist. Back in that day, he was making big bucks. I mean, his entire life has been one of big bucks. But, you know, hey, if the big bucks guys don't want to be on the Supreme Court, that's fine. I'd love to see this country is full of very good, very competent lawyers who would think that $203,000 a year is mind-bogglingly big money.
Well, it seems like you could definitely afford to, you know, conduct your life in a manner that, you know, you could manage to be Supreme Court justice for that amount of money. I'm sure I could, but it's true. I mean, my husband works for a smaller business, and his boss, the owner, was in a very bad car accident in February of last year. And because my husband had worked there a long time and knew the workings of the business, and the other person there was in the same boat, and they were friends, the business is still going today. I mean, if they had just been a quote-unquote employee, you know, there wouldn't have been that motivation. And I think that loyalty and morale are the two most appreciated resources in the workforce today.
I agree. And they come with small and medium-sized businesses. And what we're seeing as a result of this absolute unregulated laissez-faire capitalism is the destruction of small and medium-sized businesses and this huge aggregation. Sarah, I got to run. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate
it.
David in San Francisco. Quick comment, David?
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Yeah,
I was kind of interested in this whole neocon that had called earlier from the Ayn Rand Institute, and I think he ought to take a little credit for Ayn Rand Institute being one of those neocon institutions. They were pretty much the ones that that inspired all of this corruption that we have today. And
well, they inspired the philosophy that I would argue is behind the corruption, but they would say that they're absolutely opposed to the corruption. They consider themselves, and I think deep down inside they really are, they consider themselves noble holders of a positive flame.
Yeah, but they can't prove it, right?
Right. And that's the problem. There's never been a laissez-faire society. It never has been. David, thank you for the call. We got to take a break here. I appreciate the call, though. Right now, time for the Tom Hartman Program Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question for the day, effective today, which member of Congress is now arguably the most powerful woman in the world? The sixth caller with the correct answer, 1-866-440-THOM. 866-440-8466 gets an autographed and personalized copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Answer right after the break, 45 minutes past the hour.
My bills are all due, and the babies need shoes, but I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter a pound, and I'm busted. I got a cow that went dry, and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that get bigger each day. The county will haul my belongings away. I'm busted.
Ah, yes, the wonderful Republican world. I'm back. Congratulations to our winner here. Our question for the day in our progressive pop quiz, effective today, which member of Congress is now arguably the most powerful woman in the world? And Andrew, by the way, tells me that on the screen there that they're seeing, it's at Air America headquarters, that he sees that Nancy Pelosi has managed to surround herself with an army of children. Anyhow, congratulations to John Caldwell in Bremerton, Washington. There you go. Congratulations, John. John knew that the name of the most powerful woman in the world, arguably, is Nancy Pelosi. And congratulations for winning our progressive pop quiz. The second most powerful woman in the world, of course, is Victoria Jones, our accredited White House correspondent with talkradionews.com, the Talk Radio News Service, our Capitol correspondent. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, yes, I'm in room H122 of the Capitol building today. The Democrats are having a radio row, a celebratory radio row, of course, on their first day of taking power.
That's marvelous. That's marvelous. Do you have somebody there with you, or are you just hanging out with us?
I'm hanging out with you.
Oh, that's nice. So, how's it going? Here we have George Bush. He just signed the signing statement saying that he can open anybody's mail.
Can open my mail now.
I know. It's like he's like spitting in the face of the Democratic Party.
It's amazing.
I dare you. You know, that's what he's saying.
I mean, you know, when you think about where can you actually get a dirty missive from your boyfriend now? You can't get it through email because that's open to everybody. So I was thinking maybe I could get it through the old-fashioned mail, and now that's not even available to me.
And if he comes over and just whispers in your ear, Bush can listen in without a warrant as well.
Well, he's listening in and the phone's bugged, so forget about that.
Yeah, but I mean, even in person, he can follow you around with listening devices now, and pretty soon, you know, if you're a U.S. citizen, aren't you? Yeah. You became a U.S. citizen some time ago. Pretty soon your passport and your driver's license are going to have RFID chips in them. So all they have to do is just kind of go, you know, fly a helicopter over with a scanner and they'll know exactly where you are at all times. They can track your cell phone if it's made in the last year and a half. They can listen to your conversations even if you turn the thing off.
Oh, boy.
I mean, you know, that's how they busted that mafia guy down there in Florida a couple of weeks ago.
That's right, which was not a bad use of it, I guess.
I guess, but, you know, these systems in the cars that they have, they can listen in on you in the car. They use that to get the mafia guy as well. People thought that it was just for, you know, help. You know, I'm falling, I can't get up. It's amazing. It's just amazing. George Orwell was right. He was just off by a few years. So
yeah.
how you know, given
but
all
the,
this...
The atmosphere here is very interesting. I've been wandering around the Capitol. I've also been over to the Senate side. I'm on the House side now. And there is an air of anticipation. There is an air of excitement. There are a lot of civilians here today, a lot of people with badges on and people visiting and spouses and kids running around, and a lot of excitement, a real sense of something about to happen. That something, of course, being legislation that's presumably going to be passed by the Democrats and not blocked by the Republicans.
Well, I think that something in a lot of people's minds is investigations which may lead to revelations, which may lead to larger actions like impeachment, although nobody will mention the word.
No, nobody will mention the word impeachment, except some people on the far left, or even maybe not the far left, the left of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
But the investigations, yes, certainly, they're going to happen, and they're going to start within the next week or so.
Good, good. I talked with Brian Baird this morning, and he was, you know, all gung-ho about this, that they're going to start getting to the bottom of things. But I'm baffled. Why would George Bush attach a signing statement to a postal law that, you know, we had a caller earlier from the Seattle area who talked about how the postal union worked so hard for well over a year to get this postal reform in place. I mean, this is a very important piece of legislation. And the law itself reaffirms the sanctity of the mail, the privacy of the mail. Why would George Bush attach a signing statement to it saying, you know, I don't have to follow this law, I'm separate from, you know, why would he do that?
Well, I mean, maybe this was the only opportunity. I mean, he couldn't really attach it to a bill that had to do with the price of eggs.
Maybe. No, but I mean, why, you know, doesn't he realize, or maybe, I think he does. I think that, you know, that this is going to provoke an outraged response and an investigation by Congress. Is he trying to bring this to a head, this whole doctrine of the imperial presidency?
It wouldn't surprise me if he is. I don't think he's afraid of a fight.
Well, actually, I think he relishes it.
Exactly.
I think he thinks that he'll gain more power with the fight because he, unlike Richard Nixon, see, if Richard Nixon got in a fight, basically most Americans would sit back and go, you know, come on, the guy's hiding something. He's spying on the Democrats. We know what he's up to. This guy's corrupt. And that would be the end of it. But Bush has this multi-billion-dollar right-wing spin machine at his disposal in Fox News and the Washington Times and you know, hundreds of hours of right-wing talk radio every day, which didn't exist when Richard Nixon was president. I think he thinks that he can have the exact same investigations, the exact same fight that Nixon had, but he can win it.
And he thinks that this issue, once you get into things like opening people's mail and you start to talk about war on terror, Al-Qaeda, you can get away from Iraq and you can start to talk about the people who we're really fighting, and that the American people will come around on that issue.
Except that we're not really fighting them.
Well, he doesn't necessarily take that bit of it into account.
I mean, Osama bin Laden's been hiding in a cave in Pakistan for the last 5 years and we're doing nothing.
Oh,
we're not
fighting. You had to bring it up, didn't you?
I did. I know.
You just did.
I know. It's just, you know, life is tough. It's you get your pleasures where you can, but it's yes, and Bush, of course.
So I don't know where he is. Nor, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him.
Yeah, yeah. Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Amazing. Amazing. And the news rolls on, you know. It's just the news rolls on. We'll pick up some more. Nancy Pelosi, today we change the direction of our country while Bush wants to open our mail. And Joe Lieberman in an interesting battle. I'll tell you about that right after the news. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. You know, I'll just leave it at that this time. Today's the day the Democrats are getting sworn in. We'll see. Are they going to be the real Democrats, or are they going to be the DLC Democrats? We'll see. Harriet Myers just resigned. It becomes effective at the end of the month. Harriet Myers, the Bush loyalist, she's one of the lawyers for Bush, Bush loyalist who he had appointed to the Supreme Court and then took down because the right-wingers thought she wasn't far right enough. They wanted a serious right-wing crackpot, which they got at Sam Alito, rather than somebody who might be just, you know, a moderate right-wing crackpot. So Harriet Myers has resigned. The interesting piece over in the New York Times today about the Padilla case, I guess. Now Jose Padilla wants his name called Padilla. He did for a while want it called Padilla. Interesting, you know, how all that stuff kind of shakes out. George W. Bush saying that he can open your mail. All he has to do is construe you. Yeah. A right-wing talk show host who will go unnamed, because I don't want to give the guy more publicity than he deserves, has put on his website, any member of Congress who introduces, co-sponsors, or votes in favor of any such amnesty, this is for illegal aliens, will be declared a domestic enemy and will be considered a legitimate target for assassination. Yeah, see, we may have to assassinate some of the people you elect on November 7th. This could be your last election chance to save this republic. What? Yeah, welcome to the wonderful world of right-wing cranks. Extreme right-wing cranks. But, it, you know, it's a spectrum. You know, there are some who are a little more extreme than others, but they all tend to share the same worldview philosophy, which is, you know, violence first, our way or the highway, all that kind of stuff. House Democrats say that they're going to do ethics reform. Now, what I thought was interesting about this whole ethics reform thing, I think David Sirota has a great take on this. He sent out an email yesterday on this. The Democrats are this big bragging point of Pelosi and everybody else. And, you know, God bless them. I mean, it's a great start. But their big bragging point is we're gonna break the link between lobbyists and legislation. We're gonna drain the swamp. And Sirota talks about how his brother, who's a doctor, calls him up and says he was appalled that Democrats were actually bragging about banning things that most people can't believe are actually legal in the first place. He says, what are we going to hear next? Are they going to have a press conference bragging about a new bill that bans politicians from murdering each other? We now have a Congress. This is what David Sirota says. He says, we now have a Congress basically trying to tell us that somehow it's an act of courage to ban behavior that never should have been legal in the first place. I mean, they're going to ban lawmakers and staffers from accepting trips, gifts, and meals from lobbyists. Oh, bribery is no longer legal. Gee, that takes incredible courage. Well, actually, here's how bizarre it is in Washington, D.C. For Republicans, it would not only take courage, it would be impossible. For the Democrats, for some of the corporatist Democrats, the Democrats who live and die based on what the corporations who feed them are going to do, the Democrats who think that a corporatist agenda is a moderate agenda, I guess it does indicate some kind of courage, a willingness to stand up to Rahm Emanuel or something. I don't know. Bottom line, David Sirota says, everyone in Washington understands the only way to really limit corruption is to publicly finance elections. It's what Bernie Sanders has been saying on this program for 3 years. It's what I've been saying and writing about for the better part of 10 years. It's the only constitutional way to provide resources to political candidates that don't come with the expectation of legislative favors. And David Sirota then says, I want to repeat, everyone in Washington understands this. But they don't want it to happen. And he points out, you know, hey, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. My cliche, not David Sirota's. But he says, over there you have Dick Gebhardt's former chief of staff opening up his own lobbying firm for companies like Shell Oil, Nancy Pelosi's longtime chief of staff trading in his congressional ID for lobbyist badge for drug companies like Amgen. It's a sellout culture. It's tragic. It's a sellout culture. And, you know, good on them, good first step, but we need to go so much farther than that. We need to go so much farther than that. John in Chandler, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I just want to let you know you're a huge inspiration to me every single day.
Well, thank you, John, and thank you for listening to us there.
Hey, Tom, I really don't have a particular thing I want to say, but I just kind of want to share with you. I'm 35 years old, and, you know, I am just a very sad individual living in the United States just because it just looks like the United States has become weak. The way President Bush, Criminal Bush, has divided everybody with all of his crimes he's committed. I mean, just to see everything that's going on is just totally disheartening to me. And every time I see young kids walking around, it just makes me sad that their future does not look good.
John, have
you know,
hope. Have
yeah.
Hope. Listen, Bill Clinton raised the progressive income tax. He raised tax rates by what, 4%, 3-4% at the top rates? And that
yeah.
is enough to throw the government into a surplus. This problem, I mean, we have a very real problem here. Yes, absolutely. For example, you know, we're going to spend $300 billion this year just on interest on the national debt that was run up just by Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., and Bush Jr. And these guys are seriously raping this country. And people like George Bush Jr., who was born with a giant trust fund and treasury bills, are the ones who are getting our tax dollars when we pay the interest on the national debt. Yes, I mean, all of that's true. The government's running in the red. Our trade policies are insane. All of that. But it's all basically happened in the last 26 years. All of it is stuff that can be changed. It can all be. None of these are not like huge. Well, there are some huge changes. The you know, doing away with habeas corpus and Bush saying that he can listen into our phone conversations. But they're not things that have never happened before. John Adams did this stuff in 1798, and we pulled back from it. Abraham Lincoln, to a certain extent, did this kind of stuff. Franklin Roosevelt, for all the good things he did, he put the Japanese on the West Coast in concentration camps. I mean, we have walked right up to the edge in this country so many times, and we always manage to pull back. I believe that this country has burned into our DNA democracy, the highest and most powerful egalitarian ideals of the Enlightenment thinkers, the thinkers from the 16 and 1700s, and the what today you would call liberal ideals,
right.
and that we are going to go back to it. This is a transitional period, John. Don't despair. Get active. Take that emotion and convert it into some kind of energy.
Hey, Tom, I do, and I got one more thing I'd like to say.
Sure.
Hey, Tom, I really hope that the Democrats do hold Criminal Bush accountable for what he's done, because that's the reason why, you know, we, the people, have taken the big change in 2006 with having the Democrats come in now. And, you know, this whole thing with Saddam Hussein being, you know, hung, I mean, how is Bush any better than him? When's Bush going to have his time?
Well, I'd say Bush is a lot better than Saddam Hussein. But we also have to, I wouldn't even make the comparison. I just don't think that that's a valid comparison. Saddam Hussein was, you know, a murderous dictator, and he was our murderous dictator, and that's why Bush didn't want to have a real trial in the criminal court. And it's crazy that we had a trial in a country that's in the middle of a civil war. I mean, you just don't do that. And it's crazy. I mean, just everything about that was wrong. But setting all that aside, I think that the larger issue is that you said it's great that the Democrats are going to hold Bush accountable. I think that what's more important than the Democrats holding Bush accountable is, John, that you and I hold the Democrats accountable.
Yes, that's very important to me. You know, and it's also very sad to see that these people are spending time in prison for petty crimes, and we got this guy free.
Yeah, absolutely, and drug crimes and things like that. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that needs to get done. But the bottom line is, if we don't get out there and get politically active, if we don't show up at the local party meetings, if we don't contact our elected representatives on a regular basis, you know, like Bernie Sanders said, get 50 or 100 people together and rent a hall, and then let your member of Congress know, hey, we'd like you to come speak to us because we're going to be sitting here waiting for a conversation with you, or your senators know, and you know, get active, get out there and get active and get participating, because if we don't hold the Democrats accountable, they will slide back into apathy, and they will slide back into the Republican light status that they've been at for the last 15 years. And we just can't have it. It'll be a bad thing for America. John, thanks.
I really love your show. Please come to Arizona one day. I'd love to.
I would love to. Phoenix is one of my favorite cities. I haven't been there in way too long. Thanks, John. Great to hear from you. 16 minutes past the hour, 866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Back with your phone calls. Also, you can drop into our live chat room at TomHartmann.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. We'll be right back.
He's a cowboy president, but he wears a black hat. fortune again, and he's got the knack. He's the cowboy president, but he wears a black hat.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour in the Darwinian world of ideas. We're at the top of the food chain here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Jack Murtha announces he has plans to deny Bush funding for troop increases. It's going to get real interesting here. It's going to get real interesting. So we'll see how this all shakes out. For some reason, my computer just went nuts. Anyhow, the question in my mind is, to how much, to what extent are the Democrats going to stand up to Bush? And the point that I think is so important to make is that they are only going to do it to the extent that we encourage them to. We were all on the phone back when insane nominees were being put forward for the Supreme Court and, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And to the extent that we are out there being active and raising our voices, that's the extent to which they will themselves be accountable to holding Bush accountable. Otherwise, ain't going to happen. Ain't going to happen. Bob in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Bob.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
Oh, I just wanted to take exception to your statement that Bush is better than Saddam. I think he's shown himself to be far, far worse. The outside estimate of Saddam's killing of his own people is about 300,000, isn't that right?
No, if you include the war with Iran, it pushes over 2 million.
Oh, close to 2 million. So then let's put Bush and his father together with Udi Kuse and Saddam, and they're about equal.
Yeah. You know, there is a difference. George W. Bush went to war. Yes, he lied us into the war, but he went to war with a piece of paper that Congress handed him.
Well,
there is some sharing.
He actually didn't. He went to war with a piece of paper that said, before you go to war, come back and check with us again.
You're right. And it said was...
And the other thing is, ask Jose Padilla if he can get back to Stockholm syndrome.
No, I agree with you. What Bush is doing is terrible. But for every Jose Padilla in America, there were 100 of them in Iraq. I don't want to be, you know, I'm very
Tom, can I just make there were. But is 100 tortures worse than one, or are they equivalently bad to the victim? You know, is a guy who tortures just his little brother and never gets to anybody else, should he not be answerable for his crimes versus the guy who tortures the neighbor's kid too?
Yeah.
My point is
that we go down a really dangerous road as Americans. And really, ultimately, I think a fallacious road, a silly road, when we start trying to compare or dissect or say, you know, Bush is better or worse than Saddam or you know, like I just, you know, I'm just not going to go there. I'm sorry. They are very, very different circumstances. George W. Bush has committed high crimes and misdemeanors. Clearly, he has bragged about it. Wiretapping our telephones, starting a war of aggression. The last large industrial power that started a war of aggression was when Hitler's Germany invaded Poland. I mean, Bush has committed war crimes, in my opinion. He's done a number of things that he needs to be held accountable for. In order to vilify him, we don't need to compare him with Saddam. And Saddam obviously had done a whole bunch of things wrong, but he has his whole long history with the Bush family. And obviously that's why the Bush family, you know, Bush wanted to make sure that Saddam did not get tried in the International Court at The Hague. But that's a whole separate thing. And I think that by conflating these things, we're just going down a road that's not particularly useful. I'm just, you know, I'm not going to go there. I'm sorry. James in Seattle. Hey, James.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a couple points. I'll try to be as brief as I can. But my father claims to be a libertarian. We go around and around in circles and talk about, you know, deregulation. And I simply say to him, you know, do you like to have your food regulated when it's transported to stores and grocers? You already have people trying to cut corners on regulations now. I mean, you think people are going to go by the honor system? So when you start really picking it apart, you know, I think they forget to how they do benefit from regulation.
The libertarian worldview that ultimately the market will decide has two fundamental flaws. The first is that it's reactive rather than proactive. In other words, we're not going to do anything until a bunch of people have died and we've noticed it. And what about those people who died? What, you know, if we knew in advance, or some of us knew in advance, why didn't we tell the rest of us? Why didn't we do something about it? So, number one, it's reactive. And secondly, it does work in small societies. I mean, in a small town, if you've got an incompetent doctor or a butcher who's shorting people or has lousy food or, you know, whatever, people, you know, word's going to travel and they're going to go out of business. That's true. There is some truth to that. But once you have a community that's more than a few hundred people or a few thousand people, it is possible for the sociopaths among us, for the predators among us, to behave in an anonymous fashion. And that anonymity that comes with the major cities, and now, you know, we're hitting the threshold where the majority of us are urban dwellers in the United States, that requires that society protect, that we protect ourselves from the predators among us. So, James, good point, and those are my two main objections to the whole libertarian philosophy. As I said, I just think of libertarians as Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid, and it ain't good enough for me. I'm sorry. I'd like to see an actual society that works. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Live on lots of money. It makes a lot to say. Spends his days counting in the garage by the motorway.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a quick heads up, by the way. Tomorrow I will be doing my program live from WPTT, 1360WPTT.com, their website. WPTT, our affiliate in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and tomorrow night at 7 o'clock I'll be at Borders in Monroeville, Pennsylvania, signing Screwed, actually giving about an hour-long rant, and then signing the book Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And then in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on Saturday, day after tomorrow, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I will be doing a book signing on behalf of Bookstore Magers and Quinn, which will be held at the Lindale United Church of Christ, which is at 31st Street and Aldrich Avenue South in Minneapolis. That'll be 2 o'clock, January 6th in Minneapolis. So check it out. Should be fun. I'm looking forward to it. So hopping on a plane here as soon as I get off the air. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Dick in Ontario, Canada. Hey, Dick, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom.
What's up?
I was listening to you yesterday, and you were talking about the way the Bush administration sent people in to help map the Iraqi economy so that it's a model neocon economy, right?
Yeah.
And you were talking about how what a great success that's been.
Well,
you know,
and they actually thought it was going to be a success, and they intended to brag about it.
And the irony of it, and I'm not sure if you've brought this up before any other time, is that they did exactly the same thing in Russia, and look what an incredible success that's been. Because if you think about it, the wall came down in, what, 89,
right,
and Clinton came in 94. And in the meantime, in that time period, the World Bank and all these people, they all sent on all these advisors in the United States.
Shock
into
therapy.
Russia, sorry, right?
Yeah, the shock therapy. I was in Russia when that happened.
That's right. And they did the same kind of a game. They wanted to create a market economy, and what they ended up, they wanted to sell off all the government-run industries, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly the same game. So they've had these two incredible successes that they can really claim.
And now Putin is backing away from it very quickly. And tragically, as he's repudiating capitalism, he's also repudiating democracy. I think because he believed, there's a whole variety of reasons. I mean, Putin, deep down in his heart, is a tyrant, in my opinion. I mean, he was the head of the KGB. But
I agree with that. But on the other hand, he may also have a runaway train on his hands.
Yeah, well, the problem is that what got sold to the Russian people, and got sold to Putin as well, but sold to the Russian people in the media, was that democracy and capitalism are the same thing. And,
exactly.
And frankly, they had been believing that for a long time. I mean, that's what Ayn Rand believed. She went through, you know, her father lost his pharmacy in the Bolshevik Revolution. She went through college in Kiev in the 1930s and 40s through the Soviet system, and then moved to the United States in the 1950s, and believed, and you've, it's really obvious in her writings, that that capitalism is a form of governance, and it's not. It's a form of managing an economy, or not even managing an economy. It's an economic system.
Well, but the other thing is the whole issue of how do you move from a socialist, capital S socialist, state-run economy to a capitalist economy in one swell swoop. That has to be done on a very gradual and incremental fashion.
Yeah.
Common sense would tell you that. And I remember at the time when it happened that I was thinking to myself, and I hope I'm not insulting you, thinking, oh, there's the Americans going in there telling everybody that they should run things the way they do. And I knew at the time, this isn't going to work, right?
Yeah, no, you're not insulting me.
and now with what's happened in Iraq, I've realized it's not Americans as a whole. I happen to be a dual citizen, so I'm also an American, so I can say that. But it's these people with this corporatist approach and this corporatist agenda.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I was in Kaliningrad and in Moscow. And in fact, my daughter spent a year in Russia and the Ukraine. Our oldest daughter is a linguist, and she spent a year at the old in Simferopol, where Carlos the Jackal, the old spy training school, after the Soviet Union fell, they were like, what do we do with this thing? You know, we're not training spies here anymore. So they turned into a language school. She studied Ukrainian and Russian. She's fluent in both.
Yes, you've mentioned that kind of stuff before. I didn't know it was quite that deep. Yeah.
it was interesting. And I spent some time in Russia, and I worked with an international relief organization there. And I remember, and I had been in Russia back, and I'd been in East Berlin back when it was Soviet, and you never saw poverty, you never saw wealth, and it was kind of everybody was poor, but everybody was kind of equally poor. And I'm not holding it up as a wonderful system. It was a terrible system.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember walking through the streets of Moscow and walking through the streets of Kaliningrad in the years immediately after the fall of communism and the rise of capitalism in those countries, and seeing all these people, mostly elderly pensioners, sitting on the street with their worldly belongings around them for sale. I remember sitting, Louise and I, this must have been 1986, we were in Poland, and a woman came up to us in Poland and had a whole handful, not a handful, she had them, she had very carefully put them onto a piece of cardboard, her husband's medals from the military, trying to sell them to us. Yeah, it really was. I mean, when I first saw them, I thought that it was just, you know, hey, it's junk store junk. You know, it's like Salvation Army kind of stuff. And I asked her how much, and she said, you know, $1 U.S., you know, for each one. And then I said, you know, where did you get these? And she said, these are the medals that my husband earned. And I said, is your husband still alive? And she said, no, he died last year. And I said, why are you selling these? And actually, it was the guy at the next table who was having a beer with us who spoke enough Polish to do the translation on this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, why are you selling these things? Because I can't afford to eat.
Yep.
Right. So I gave her like $50 for the medals, and then I gave her back her medals so that she could resell them to somebody else. I felt so terrible, and that's what we brought them, and it's still going on there. I can tell you, it's still going on there.
What's terrible is you've got a small number of rich people in neocons, or people who want to be rich, going there with absolutely no sense of balance, no sense of compassion, and they had a Big Bang approach to the Soviet Union, and definitely a Big Bang approach to Iraq.
Yeah.
And what amazes me is that this isn't talked about. That's what's, I mean, there's a lot of interesting things that have come up that obviously Bush and his administration have a massive number of problems. But this is something that's pretty serious at the core. Is their theory is to take the neocon agenda and spread it around the world. And guess
that's
what?
Right.
The rest of the world doesn't want.
Yeah, Chile bought this back 20 years ago, and they privatized their social security system. It's a disaster. No, there's
Chile,
no shortage of examples about this, and I write about it, and I talk about it in this program, but I don't think that anybody else is. I agree with you, Dick, and it's something that needs to be talked about more. What we did with the Marshall Plan in Europe and in Japan to a certain extent, but largely in Europe, when we went in and we said, we're going to encourage countries to reinvent their constitutions with strong protections for labor, with national health care systems, companies, and we're going to give, instead of bringing in American companies and doing this to our benefit, we're going to give money to your government to give to buy services from local companies to build local industry. I mean, General George Marshall and Harry Truman, they got it right, and it worked. And the neocons have been trying to prove them wrong. They tried to prove them wrong in Russia. They tried to prove them wrong in Argentina. They tried to prove them wrong in Poland and in Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia. They're trying to prove them wrong in the Ukraine. They're trying to prove them wrong in Iraq. And every single time they come in and do this so-called shock therapy, and Wolfowitz and the World Bank and all these guys, what you end up with is an absolute flaming, screaming disaster and people dying.
Time after time.
Yeah, and I can tell you, I've been there and I've seen it with my own eyes. Dick, thanks so much for a very thoughtful and insightful call.
Oh, thanks, Tom.
I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Ed in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ed, I'm listening on WPTT, where I'll be tomorrow. What's up?
Hey, Tom.
Yes, sir.
I have a question. I understand the Democrats have the majority in the Congress.
Yeah.
But they don't have the three-quarters majority. Do you think that they could embarrass the Republicans into that three-quarter majority so they could rescind the last 7 to 10 bills that King George signed and move things a little faster for...
Are you talking about the suggestion that I made yesterday based on a suggestion one of my callers here in Portland made that the Democrats should say to the Republicans that the House rules, the rules of under which the House of Representatives are run, should stay the same as they were under the Republicans. That is to say, the minority party has no power until the Republicans agree to a rule that says that the rules of the House can't be changed without 75% plus one vote. And then let's make the rules more egalitarian, but that way they're locked in there. Is that what you're talking about?
I think that's what I said, but I didn't hear that caller from Portland.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought that was actually a very wise suggestion. And why would the Democrats need a three-quarters majority to do anything right now? I mean, they have to be to be veto-proof. You mean?
Yeah, to veto because surely King George will not sign it saying we're going to rescind all these bills I just signed.
Yeah.
So they're going to have three-quarters majority to get it past him.
Yeah. Well, I am hopeful that there are enough Republicans of goodwill and Republicans who would like to survive politically that's not going to be an issue. But this is the amazing thing about American democracy, Ed. We get to watch all this stuff happen right out in the open. And, as the old Chinese curse, we live in interesting times. We'll see how it shakes out. Thanks a lot for the call. I got to run and take a break here. We'll be back in just a minute with more of your calls. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the radio support group of By and For. As the first sentence of the opening of the preamble of the Constitution says, we the people, I'd say of the planet, not just the United States, of the planet. We can be a little U.S.-centric, I suppose, but you just got a caller from Canada. 45 minutes after the hour.
Yes, me friend, them set me free again.
And welcome back, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Let's just take a quick look at what's going on with the U.S. ongoing invasion, occupation, rather, of Iraq before we get back to your calls.
I want to know the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lies in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the cannon. There are blood on the wire.
Following our security developments in Iraq as of 1,000 hours Greenwich Mean Time on Thursday. This from Reuters. Dateline Baghdad, two car bombs near a petrol station killed 13 people and wounded 22 others in Baghdad's western upscale Mansour district, an interior ministry source said. In Hilla, the bodies of four people were found shot dead in and around the city. In Baghdad, clashes erupted between gunmen and residents of a mainly Sunni district after the gunmen attacked Baghdad's western Ghazaliya district and killed two people and wounded 25 others on Wednesday. And in Iskandaria, a roadside bomb targeting a police checkpoint killed an Iraqi soldier and wounded four. In that town, 25 miles south of Baghdad. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Lawrence in Berkeley, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Lawrence.
Hi. Apropos of the discussion that we were having before as to who's worse, George Bush or Saddam Hussein?
Yeah. See, I just think it's a lousy metaphor or analogy.
It's not George Bush that we should compare. It's the entire United States foreign policy, imperialism, if you want to call it. And I want to cite some interesting data that's very little known. In 1986, in the middle of the war between Iran and Iraq, there was a resolution before the United Nations, before the Security Council, to condemn Iraq for using poison gas. They were using mustard gas and also some nerve gases.
Actually, they were using it in the reverse order. They were hitting the Iranians with nerve gas, which paralyzed them, mm-hmm. and then they were hitting them with mustard gas, which caused them to
yes.
cough blood out of their lungs and die in their own blood.
Right.
And we provided them with both and told them how to use it.
Well, not only that, but there was a resolution in the United Nations in the Security Council to condemn the Iraqis for doing this,
right.
and it was vetoed by the United States.
Yeah, I know.
The United States was the only country which voted against it.
Well, in the Security Council, there's only there was seven or nine members. I mean, it's not like it was the entire body, but yes.
No, it was.
We have a veto in the Security Council, and we used it.
What happened was, the United States threatened to veto it, and so rather than bring it up as a formal resolution, it was brought up by as what they call a president's statement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lawrence, we've lost you. So apparently Alberto Gonzalez got to you before you were able to finish your statement there. Jake in Arcata, California. Hey, Jake, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'd like to talk about Bush's illegitimate use of the signing statement to do warrantless searches of the U.S. mail.
Yeah.
You know, this clearly is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's clearly a violation of Bush's oath of office to uphold the Constitution. And
yes.
George W. Bush should be impeached.
I agree.
Thanks, Tom. And this is much like the domestic spying program, of course, with the NSA. I mean, the NSA, by law, is prohibited from spying on American citizens in American territory.
Yeah, not just by law, by its charter.
That's right.
By the law or the whatever, the legislation that brought it into existence.
Yeah, it's absolutely illegal what they're doing. And clearly, since the FISA court is a rubber stamp for the executive branch, the FISA court has only turned down five warrant requests since its creation in 1978. Bush didn't go in front of the FISA court because they are spying on people they have no reason to be spying on. They're Democratic opposition. This is just like the dirty tricks the Nixon administration pulled.
Yeah, no, that's what I've been saying. In fact, I wrote an op-ed piece about this about a year ago, maybe a year ago for Common Dreams, in which I said that the Democrats should be out there screaming, why does Bush want to spy on Democrats? Nobody is raising that question. Nobody is raising that meme. Bush is saying he has the right to spy on anybody without going through a court. And basically, the only people that a court is going to say, no, you can't spy on these people, are using the spy agencies to go against your political opposition. Oh, no president would ever do that, people say. I'm sorry, that's what Nixon did. That's what Nixon got impeached for. Jake, excellent point. Thank you for the call. Jim in Everett, Washington. Hey, Jim, listening on KPTK. Hey, Jim.
Howdy. I was just thinking maybe the Democratic Congress could send their own signing statements up with bills to sign. They say, send a note along that says, let's make a deal. You give us a veto, we'll give you a subpoena.
Well, the bill, yeah, exactly. The bill is the signing statement, but yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, we'll give you those. Yeah, very good. Christine in Bremerton, Washington. Hey, Christine.
Hi. I'd heard on Twice on America that Bechtel was leaving Iraq. Is
yes.
this true? And are they going to be? Can we figure out whether they did what they got paid for? I can take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Sure. You're welcome. I believe it's true that they are leaving Iraq, and whether there will be oversight of you know what Bechtel did while they were there, or Halliburton, or any other contractor for that matter, is in the hands of the Democratic Party right now. And I would submit to you, it's not even in the hands of the Democratic Party. It's in the hands of you and me. We have to decide whether we're going to put the pressure on these guys to do something. Milt in Seattle. Hey, Milt, I'm sorry. We just flat ran up against the edge of the show here. Ran out of time. But on tomorrow's program, the first hour of the day, Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Second hour, conservative judge, a sitting judge, Robert Dierker, who says that there is a liberal judicial assault in our courts by, get this, the femifascists. He's going to try and convince us about this. In the third hour, I'll be writing our book online, Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. We're going to be talking about chunking and framing. That and the news of the day and your calls on the Tom Hartman program tomorrow. And don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow live from Pittsburgh.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.